This program is intended for a print impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Thank you to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, I will bring you news from the Spencer New Leader and the Athol Daily News. Today, I will read from the July 31st, 2026 edition of the Spencer New Leader and various dates from the Athol Daily News. I'm Walter Byrd with Audio Journal, and we begin with a reading of news from the Spencer New Leader, a publication of Stonebridge Press Newspapers, which is free by request to residents of East Brookfield, West Brookfield, North Brookfield, Brookfield, Leicester, and Spencer. Again, this is the Friday, July 31st, 2026 edition. Our first story by Jason Blue, the correspondent for Spencer New Leader. Brookfield enters contract for water operations. Blue writes, the town of Brookfield is proceeding with a contract that would see a third-party entity operate the town's water treatment plant while local officials determine a path forward for the vacant superintendent post. At a meeting in late July, the Brookfield Select Board approved a contract with East National Water LLC to take over operations of the town's water treatment facility at a cost of $8,250 per month, paid for through funds currently budgeted for primary and secondary operators. Donald Taft, chair of the town's Water Commission, explained the situation resulted from difficulties filling the superintendent position. In December, the town had partnered with a secondary operator who ran the plant until February. At that time, a new superintendent had been hired who had yet to be approved for his T1 treatment license. The state had approved a six-month emergency operator certificate to allow the new superintendent to run the plant. However, as the end of that timeline drew to a close, the town learned the new hire's T1 application was not approved. The superintendent submitted a two-week notice on July 1st, forcing Brookfield to take swift action to put a plan in place for operating starting next month. The Water Commission held an emergency meeting and approved the contract with East National Water LLC. They then presented it to the Select Board on July 16th, who also approved the contract with a plan to proceed with a superintendent search. Taft said they did their due diligence when choosing the company, even on a tight timeline, and feel confident that East National Water LLC will provide exceptional service during the duration of the contract. Taft said, quote, we reached out to any number of water operators, engineering firms, companies that have been approved by MassDEP or that have worked for other communities. This company has worked for about five or six different communities where they ran their system. We did reach out to a number of communities, and they were very pleased with the services they were provided, end quote. With a temporary plan in place, attention turned to the future and whether a third-party operator versus a higher superintendent should be explored as a permanent solution. Taft admitted there has been little interest in the job. Select person Richard Chafee noted, continuing with a third-party operator might actually be a better option for the town. Chafee said, quote, I think this may be the best solution to the problem, even in the long term. If it works out, it's certainly more cost-effective in the end, end quote. All parties admitted there's plenty of nuance that needs to be worked out and explored before the town makes any final decision on that front. For now, Brookfield will proceed with a full-time superintendent search and has a solid plan in place now to keep things running in the meantime. And next up, there is a standalone photo on the front page of this week's Spencer New Leader. The caption reads, during the July 21st meeting of the Leicester Select Board, Police Chief Kenneth Antonovica and town leadership took a moment to recognize a longtime and beloved officer embarking upon his well-deserved retirement. Michael Lombardozzi, or Lombo as he is affectionately known, officially retired this past month after 18 dedicated years of service to the town of Leicester. Lombo was the epitome of a dedicated public servant, and from his military service to the nation in the U.S. Coast Guard to his 18 years with the town of Leicester, he has left an indelible mark on the town for others to aspire to. And there is a picture of the chief presenting Lombo with a framed and folded United States flag. Up next, registration open for Brookfield Lions Club Golf Tournament. Out of North Brookfield, registration is now open for the 2026 Brookfield Lions Club Golf Tournament, according to event chair Mark Kukanski. The annual event takes place Saturday, August 22nd at Quail Hollow Country Club, 1822 Old Turnpike Road in Ocam. The four-person scramble tournament begins with registration at 12 p.m., followed by a 1 p.m. shotgun start. The entry fee is $100 per golfer, which includes 18 holes of golf, cart, skins competition closest to the pin contest and a meal following the tournament at Quail Hollow Country Club. Proceeds from the tournament will benefit the Brookfield Lions Club's charitable programs and community service projects throughout the area. Through fundraising events such as this tournament, the club supports local organizations and individuals while carrying out the Lions' mission of serving those in need. To register a team or obtain additional information, contact Mark Krakansky at 508-847-9843. Registration is open now through August 15th. As the world's largest, youngest, and most active service organization, the mission of Lions Clubs International is to empower volunteers to serve their communities, meet humanitarian needs, encourage peace, and promote international understanding. The members of the Brookfield Lions Club are dedicated to service and support in the communities of Brookfield, East Brookfield, North Brookfield, West Brookfield, and New Braintree. Vendors wanted for flea market on West Brookfield Common. The First Congregational Church at 36 North Main Street, West Brookfield, UCC, has been hosting their flea market on the town common for more than 50 years. This year, the flea market will be held on Saturday, September 12th, from 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., with vendor check-in from 6:30 to 8:30 a.m. The sellers of all kinds are welcome: flea folk, antiques dealers, crafters, product vendors, and those emptying out basements and attics. No food vendors, please. Spaces are available for $40 for a 20 by 20 foot grassy spot. Vendors must bring their own tables and tents. The church will sponsor a food tent with grilled food, cold drinks, and sweet treats. Email fccofwbfleamarket@gmail.com for an application, or call Karen at 508-801-7692. That email again, fccofwbfleamarket@gmail.com, or call Karen at 508-801-7692. Mark your calendars. The tradition continues. Up next, Alex Cordy Memorial Golf Tournament set for September 12th. In Oak Camp, St. Carlo Acutis Parish, Brookfield, West Brookfield, Warren, is having their 9th annual Alex Cordy Memorial Charity Golf Tournament at Quail Hollow Golf and Country Club, 1822 Old Turnpike Road, in Oak Camp, Saturday, September 12th. Registration begins at 7:15 a.m. with a shotgun start at 8 a.m. As many of you are aware, Alex Cordy was an integral part of our West Brookfield community for many years. In memory of his outstanding service to his community, his parish, and being a founding member of the Knights of Columbus Council 11080, this tournament will once again benefit our Youth Activities Fund to support the youth in our local community, a cause that was very important to Alex. We were able to award two $1,000 scholarships this past year from the proceeds of the event to two local high school seniors, as well as fund many other youth activities. We ask that you please consider supporting our event by sponsoring or participating in the tournament individually or with a foursome. Tournament raffle items and general donations to this event are always welcome and appreciated. Registration and sponsorships are available for the tournament. To register and for more information, call 413-813-8100 or email wallyconnor122@gmail.com. That's Wally, W-A-L-L-Y, Connor, C-O-N-N-O-R, 122, the number 122, at gmail.com. Local students named to Holy Cross's Spring Dean's List. In Worcester, College of the Holy Cross congratulates the students named to the Spring 2026 Dean's List for outstanding academic achievement during the spring semester of the 2025-26 academic year. The following local students made the list: Tatiana Kulbar of Spencer, class of 2026, Jenna Dupel of North Brookfield, class of 2026, and Timothy St. John of Leicester, class of 2026. The Weekly Police Blotter has this information out of Spencer. The Spencer Police Department reported the following arrests during the week of July 15th to the 21st. Lisa L. Brown, age 57, of Leicester, was arrested on July 19th in connection with a warrant. In Leicester, an individual whose identity has been withheld from publication received a summons in lieu of arrest on July 16th for operating a motor vehicle after suspension of registration and operating an unregistered motor vehicle. An individual whose identity has been withheld from publication received a summons in lieu of arrest on July 17th for operating a motor vehicle after suspension of license. Lawrence Cologne, age 40, of Spencer, was arrested on July 17th for operating a motor vehicle after suspension of license, subsequent offense. A motor vehicle equipment violation, seatbelt, and operating a vehicle with no inspection sticker. An individual whose identity has been withheld from publication received a summons in lieu of arrest on July 18th for attempting to commit a crime. An individual whose identity has been withheld from publication received a summons in lieu of arrest on July 21st for shoplifting by asportation. Local residents to participate in PanMass Challenge to support cancer research. The August 1st and 2nd PanMass Challenge brought together more than 6,000 cyclists and 4,000 volunteers to raise money for cancer research and patient care at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Participants from local communities were among those helping to support the PMC's mission to fund life-saving cancer research and treatment. Local participants, who started out of Worcester this year for the first time in several years, included Pam Rockwood of North Brookfield, Meredith Laughlin of West Brookfield, Robert Laughlin of West Brookfield, David Balducci of West Brookfield, Jessica Perowski of West Brookfield, Matthew Pillsbury of Spencer, Margaret Pillsbury of Spencer, Erin Rosalind of Spencer, Michael Jagir of Rochdale, Seth Cormier of North Brookfield, Richard Carr of Leicester, Stephen Lefamine of East Brookfield, Susan Brogan of Brookfield, Ellen Varnum of Brookfield, and Cecilia Gray of Brookfield. Local students graduate from Nichols College. This is what's next in the Spencer New Leader. Nichols College congratulates the 2026 graduating class who earned their academic degrees at the college's commencement ceremony on May 2nd, 2026 at the DCU Center in Worcester. Delcy D. Bean IV, founder and CEO of Paragus IT, an employee-owned managed information technology services firm that is one of the most successful, fastest-growing IT firms in the region, delivered the commencement address. The following local students earned the degrees listed. Brennan O'Gurd of Spencer, a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. Stephen Comtross III of Brookfield, a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. Holly Eckhart of Brookfield, a Master of Science in Counterterrorism. Kiana Barnes of East Brookfield, a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. Nicholas Michaelian of Leicester, a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. Colin Wallace of North Brookfield, a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. Ashley Ottman of North Brookfield, a Master of Business Administration. James Manzaro of West Brookfield, a Master of Science in Organizational Leadership. We applaud these students for their achievement. And UMass Amherst announces its Spring's Dean's List. The following students were named to the Spring 2026 Dean's List at the University of Massachusetts. Students are appointed to the Dean's List at the end of a semester in which they have completed a minimum of 12 graded credits and have earned a grade point average of 3.5 or better. Brookfield, Rosalie Burnett, Cody Chen, Aiden Earl, Michael Allen Frey, Abigail Grace Hildick, Ayla Shea Iraniak, Samuel Kiare Kibi, Josephine Grace Landon, Gage Willem Lane, Jacob Alexander Lanny, Emma Ann McGinty, Lily Marie Melanson, Sierra Murray, Aman Ahila, Jacob Michael Peterson, Jared J. Peterson, James Quinn, Eleanor June Reynolds, Sydney Riley Warren. In Leicester, Jacob George Altman, Aaron Nicole Gerber, Gabrielle Marie Pietri. In Rochdale, Jillian Marie Morrison. From Spencer, William Robert Anderson, John Peter Bowler, Zachary Edward Hinman, Lane Michael Perchak, Gabriella St. Ville, Zachary Solor, Angela Rose Niver, Scarlett Elizabeth Serdell, Anieta Sharif, Megan Catherine St. John, Jenny Lee Wagenhofer. And UMass Amherst announces spring graduates. Approximately 7,000 students received bachelor's degrees and over 100 majors at UMass Amherst undergraduate commencement May 15, 2026 at the McGuirk Alumni Stadium. Below is a list of students from the local area that received a bachelor's degree from UMass Amherst. In Brookfield, Caleb Maxwell Aiken, Michael William Casey, Aiden Earl, Abigail Grace Hildick, Jacob Alexander Lani, Jacob Michael Peterson, Nita O. Portillo, Sydney Riley Warren. In Leicester, Erin Nicole Gerber, Rachel Page LaPriori. And from Spencer, Lacey Marie Burt, Alexandra Marie Holmes, that's Alexandra Marie Holmes, and Tiffany Andrea Schultz. It is time for the editorial for Discussion of Leader this week. A practical solution today, a thoughtful decision tomorrow. When it comes to essential public services, there is little room for uncertainty. Residents expect that when they turn on the tap, clean, safe drinking water will be there. That expectation depends on skilled professionals working behind the scenes every day, often without much public attention. Brookfield recently found itself facing a challenge many small communities are experiencing. Qualified operators for specialized municipal positions are increasingly difficult to find. In this case, the town was confronted with the unexpected departure of its water treatment superintendent after licensing issues prevented the position from becoming permanent. Rather than allowing the situation to become a crisis, town officials acted quickly to ensure uninterrupted service by contracting with an experienced outside operator. And that deserves recognition. The Water Commission and Select Board had little time to react, yet they sought references, consulted other communities, and selected a company with an established record of operating municipal water systems. That careful approach reflects responsible stewardship of an essential public resource. Perhaps even more encouraging was the conversation that followed. Rather than viewing the contract as merely a temporary fix, local officials openly discussed whether third-party management could become a long-term option. That willingness to examine every possibility is exactly what taxpayers should expect from local government. For generations, municipalities have assumed that every essential service must be provided by in-house employees. Increasingly, however, changing labor markets are challenging that assumption. Specialized positions in water treatment, engineering, information technology, and public health have become harder to fill, particularly in small towns competing with larger communities and private industry. That does not necessarily mean outsourcing is always the answer. There are advantages to having a dedicated local superintendent who knows the system, understands the community, and can respond quickly when problems arise. Local employees often become valuable institutional resources whose experience cannot easily be replaced. At the same time, professional firms can sometimes provide broader expertise, multiple licensed operators, vacation coverage, continuing education, and regulatory compliance that would be difficult or expensive for a small town to maintain on its own. The important point is that neither model should be accepted or rejected based on tradition alone. Instead, Brookfield should evaluate whichever approach delivers the safest water, the greatest reliability, and the best value for taxpayers. Cost matters, but it should never be the only consideration. Public accountability, emergency response, institutional knowledge, regulatory compliance, and long-term stability all deserve equal weight. The encouraging news is that town leaders appear committed to making that evaluation carefully. They are continuing to search for a superintendent while allowing themselves to see how the outside contract performs before making any permanent decisions. That is not indecision. It is good governance. Sometimes the best leadership comes from acknowledging that circumstances have changed and yesterday's solutions may not automatically be tomorrow's. Communities across Massachusetts are confronting similar workforce shortages, and many will face the same questions Brookfield is asking today. Residents may ultimately prefer a traditional town employee or conclude that a qualified outside operator offers greater stability. Either outcome can be successful if it is based on facts rather than assumptions. Clean drinking water is among the most fundamental services any municipality provides. Brookfield's residents deserve a system that is reliable every day, regardless of who operates it. And for now, the town has secured that stability while taking the time to thoughtfully consider its future. That is a practical approach worthy of support. And we have this week's financial focus column from Trevor Nielsen. Building your child's education fund one brick at a time. Every solid house starts with a good blueprint and strong foundation. Saving for a child's education is very similar. College costs can seem daunting. In addition to tuition, you'll need to account for housing and food, books and supplies, transportation, and other expenses. The average annual budget at an in-state public university runs around $30,990 today, and a private school is $65,470, according to the College Board. While most families won't pay a college's list price, you'll still want to start saving as early as possible to be ready when your child is. Lay the foundation early. You don't have to wait until you have the perfect set of plans to start building. There are specific accounts designed to save for education, and some do not require a minimum opening deposit. Setting up automatic recurring contributions, even modest ones, lets you build steadily over time without requiring constant attention. As your child ages, look for ways to redirect expenses you no longer have towards the build. For example, daycare costs, which can exceed $1,000 a month, can be shifted into a college savings account once your child enters school. Tax refunds and annual bonuses make excellent additional contributions, and others can pitch in. Instead of birthday or holiday toys, ask grandparents or relatives to contribute directly to a college savings account. Know the size of the house you're building. Family saving for college, community college, followed by 2 years at a public university, might target around $65,000. Those aiming for 4 years at a public school are looking at roughly $100,000. Whatever the goal, plan for education inflation of about 4% annually, which can roughly double costs over 18 years. You don't have to source all the building materials yourself. Scholarships, grants, student loans, and income from part-time work are all legitimate ways to help finish the structure. Don't let one project consume the whole budget. One risk for parents is pouring so much into the college fund that the retirement fund goes neglected. Remember, loans and grants exist for college, but not for retirement. Striking the right balance may mean targeting a more affordable school, planning to cover only a portion of costs, or adjusting retirement timelines slightly. Choose the right building materials. For many families, a 529 plan is the right foundation. Earnings grow tax-free, distributions are federally tax-free when used for qualified education expenses, and many states offer additional income tax deductions for contributions. Even better, anyone, such as grandparents or friends, can contribute. Additionally, qualified expenses for a 529 plan go beyond tuition and cover books, computers, internet access, room and board, and more. Vocational and trade schools often qualify too, opening the door to careers in skilled trades, healthcare, and technology. No contractor builds alone. A knowledgeable financial advisor can help you draw up a realistic blueprint and make sure the college project doesn't crowd out the rest of your financial future. The earlier you break ground on that conversation, the stronger the structure will be. Next up, Lanterns Along Main Street, the column by Charles. This week's column titled, When Every Errand Took a Little Longer. And Charles writes, I had 3 stops to make the other day. On paper, it should have taken about 30 minutes. Pick up one item, drop off another, grab a gallon of milk, and head home. An hour and 15 minutes later, I finally pulled into the driveway. The funny thing is, I wasn't delayed by traffic. I was delayed by people. At the hardware store, I bumped into a fellow I hadn't seen since last fall. We spent a few minutes talking about the weather, which in New England is less a conversation starter than an ongoing community project. We compared notes on gardens, wondered whether we'd ever get enough rain, and somehow ended up discussing high school football schedules. At the post office, another familiar face asked how my wife was doing. Before I could answer, someone else joined the conversation because they had overheard the question and knew exactly who we were talking about. By the time I reached the grocery store, I had already had 3 conversations and learned about a church supper, a grandson's first job, and a neighbor's new puppy. None of it had anything to do with why I left the house. It reminded me that errands used to be more than chores. They were social occasions. You never knew who you'd run into, and that was part of the experience. If someone spotted your car in a parking lot, there was a decent chance you'd meet them inside before you made it to the checkout. Nowadays, efficiency seems to be the goal. Order online, pick up curbside, self-checkout, tap your card, head home. There's nothing wrong with any of that. Sometimes convenience is exactly what we need. But convenience has quietly eliminated some of the unexpected moments that make living in a small town feel different from living anywhere else. Those chance encounters don't accomplish much in traditional sense. They don't shorten your to-do list or make your day more productive. What they do is remind you that you're part of a community. You hear that someone's daughter earned a scholarship. You learn that a longtime business owner is finally taking a vacation. You find out a neighbor had surgery and could use someone to mow the lawn next week. None of those updates arrive through any app. They travel the old-fashioned way, one conversation at a time. I suppose that's why I've never been too bothered when an errand takes longer than expected. If I leave the house with a list of 5 things to do and come home having completed all 5, that's a successful trip. If I also come home knowing a little more about the people who share this corner of Massachusetts with me, that's an even better one. The older I get, the more I appreciate these unscheduled conversations. They can't be penciled into a calendar or squeezed between appointments. They simply happen when neighbors cross paths. I mean, that's why they're worth protecting, because someday we'll all finish our errands. What we'll remember are the people we met along the way. And by the way, a reminder for the letter submission policy at the Spencer New Leader, letters to the editor must include the author's name, address, and a daytime phone number for purposes of verification in order to be considered for publication. Only the author's name and the town in which they reside will be published. Letters submitted without all the required information will not be accepted. It is the sole prerogative of the editor to determine whether a submission satisfies the requirements and decency standards of the paper, and any submission may be rejected at any time for any reason he or she might deem appropriate. The next major collaborative milestone marked at QCC Center topping off. The Worcester Quinsigerman Community College celebrated a major construction milestone with a topping off ceremony for its new QCC Center, marking the completion of the building's structural frame. State and local leaders, project partners, and members of the college community gathered to witness the raising of the final beam and celebrate the progress of this transformational project. Through careful planning, advocacy, fundraising, design, and construction, the vision is now becoming a reality. This was according to QCC President Dr. Louis Pedraja. He said, quote, most importantly, this will create opportunities for students to develop the skills they need to succeed in today's workforce and strengthen the connection between education, industry, and our community, end quote. The event featured a ceremonial beam signing and remarks from Pedraja, State Senator Robin Kennedy, State Rep. James O'Day, Worcester Mayor Joe Petty, Assistant Secretary Robert LePage of the Massachusetts Executive Office of Education, Deputy Commissioner Dr. Richard Riccardi of the Massachusetts Department of Higher Education, Commissioner Adam Back of the Massachusetts Division of Capital Asset Management and Maintenance, or DCAM, and Craig Skirker, Operations Manager for Gilbain Building Company. Kennedy said, quote, the raising of the beam is a moment for us to give gratitude and thank those who have stepped up to make this a reality. As you join into the growing skyline of Worcester, we continue to grow with you. By signing our names to these beams, we are signing our commitment to make sure the school continues to be successful, end quote. The topping off ceremony commemorated the progress of the $37.4 million renovation and expansion project, which is transforming a 1960s-era athletic facility into a modern, accessible hub for learning, workforce development, and student life. Upon completion, the 57,000-square-foot facility will feature advanced manufacturing and robotics laboratories, hospitality training spaces, flexible classrooms, and revitalized athletic facilities. The project also includes significant upgrades to aging infrastructure and accessibility improvements designed to create a more inclusive and welcoming environment for all students. Riccardi said, quote, this project is so important to the mission and vision of Quinsigerman Community College, the region it serves, and the Commonwealth. We know holistic student success incorporates curricular and co-curricular initiatives, and this project provides the infrastructure to check both of those boxes, end quote. Speakers highlighted the collaborative partnership among the college, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and project stakeholders that have made the investment possible. O'Day said, quote, it is a necessity that we continue to improve our community college environments. The legislature has made it very clear that not only is higher ed important, but certainly the community college segment is equally as important. It's been an honor to be able to represent the college. Here's a quick look at the weather ahead in the Spencer area, and it doesn't look great. Monday the 3rd, 95% chance of thunderstorms, a high of 76, a low of 59, and the temperatures get into the 80s on Tuesday the 4th. This is a day for mostly sunny skies, so enjoy it. A high of 82 and a low of 59. But the showers continue on Wednesday the 5th, a.m. showers with a high of 81, a low of 68, and some sun is in there. Thursday the 6th, p.m. showers, a high of 85, a low of 71. Friday the 7th, evening thunderstorms, a high of 87, a low of 69. Saturday the 8th, evening thunderstorms with a high of 83 and a low of 68. And Sunday the 9th, evening thunderstorms again, a high of 84 and a low of 69 degrees. For Monday the 10th, looking out ahead for an extended forecast, evening thunderstorms with a high of 84 and a low of 65. Partly cloudy skies Tuesday the 11th as the rain seems to disappear, a high of 81 and a low of 62. Partly cloudy again on Wednesday, August 12th, a high of 77 and a low of 62. Partly cloudy again on Thursday the 13th, a high of 78 and a low of 61. Going out to Friday the 14th, a high of 76, a low of 60. Morning showers possible. A partly cloudy skies on Saturday the 15th with a high of 77 and a low of 61. And on Sunday the 16th, fog in the morning and in the evening, a high of 79 and a low of 60 degrees. We turn now to the Athol Daily News. Our first story, ownership quandary complicates Wendell Smallpox Cemetery preservation push. This is by Dominic Poli in the August 2nd, 2026 edition of the Athol Daily News. Out of Wendell, a Montague man has volunteered to restore and maintain the old smallpox cemetery at the end of Morse Village Road. The only question is, who owns it? Sylvia Weatherby, who chairs the Wendell Cemetery Commission, said the assessor's map indicates the cemetery near the New Salem town line is located inside the Whetstone Wildlife Sanctuary, which Mass Audubon owns and manages. But Aaron Gouveia, the conservation organization's public relations director, said his agency owns only the road leading up to the cemetery, not the land itself. Quote, I'm very confused, end quote, Weatherby told the recorder when informed of what Gouveia said. This issue arose when David Detmold appeared before the select board on July 15th to discuss reestablishing access to the smallpox cemetery. He volunteered to use his chainsaw to cut down 14 or 15 birch trees that are looming over the brittle headstones. Detmold would then lay down the wood to create a corduroy road or wooden pathway that he would cover with cedar boughs as a type of mat. He said the work would take about 6 hours. Weatherby said she had always believed the cemetery is on land owned by the Sawyer family. That surname appears on at least 3 headstones there. But Detmold said it was never a private burial ground, despite what he called the common narrative in town. He said, quote, I don't think the Sawyer family chose this as their family plot. I think it was chosen because it was out of the way, because they didn't want the smallpox to spread. They didn't have good sanitary procedures in those days, end quote. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, smallpox was an infectious disease caused by the variola virus. Once claiming hundreds of millions of lives over centuries, it has since been eradicated, with no cases occurring since 1977. Smallpox cemeteries were common ways to bury victims so the public would not get contaminated. According to the CDC, smallpox was contagious after death because the virus remained active in the fluid and scabs of the skin rash. At least 5 people are buried in the cemetery in Wendell with headstones bearing the names of Jabez Sawyer, Jemima Caruth Sawyer, Lydia Caruth Sawyer, Patty Caruth Hager, and Otis Holbrook. Jean Ford, who chairs the Wendell Historical Commission, recounted that it appears Holbrook was a 29-year-old traveling salesman from Western New York who brought the virus into town and infected at least 3 of the victims who rest beneath the soil. It is possible one of the women buried fell ill while trying to nurse Holbrook back to health. A 1978 Greenfield Recorder article mentions the smallpox cemetery and Mormon Hollow as 2 sites the town might choose to record as part of an historical inventory project that was set to be discussed. The society was working on the inventory as one town in the Arts Council of Franklin County's historical inventory project. To add to town officials' confusion, Forward said it is a town cemetery that was developed to isolate people who had died of smallpox. However, Weatherby said the land has never been maintained by the town, to her recollection. A 1965 article in the Recorder describes the cemetery as well-maintained, with beautifully engraved slate headstones, shortly after fear of the contagion had passed. On the question of ownership, Gouveia shared with the Recorder a deed of easement that refers to, quote, a discontinued and abandoned portion of a country road known as Morse Village Road, located between, end quote, the New Salem town line and the smallpox cemetery. And the document reads, quote, this easement is granted to the inhabitants of the town of Wendell for passage by the public on foot and by use of automobile for the purpose of visiting said smallpox cemetery in its current location only and for no other purpose. The use of automobile is hereby limited to that portion of Morse Village Road lying between the New Salem town line and the smallpox cemetery, and is hereby available only from the first day of May until the last day of November in each calendar year, between sunrise and sunset, road conditions permitting, end quote. Gouveia said this language led to Mass Audubon officials' initial belief that the cemetery was owned by the town. The deed of easement also states that Wendell residents have the right and obligation to maintain this right-of-way. However, the right-of-way may never be cleared or improved to be more than a gravel surface pathway that is 8 feet in width. The adjacent tree canopy cannot be cut more than 15 feet in height, and there can be no maintenance on the roadway between December 1st and April 30th. It reads, quote, if the road is further improved, this easement will terminate, end quote. Detmold, who said he is a Montague Tree Advisor Committee member and trained in safe chainsaw use, told the Recorder this restoration and maintenance effort was inspired by an issue in Montague in which a family denied people access to a public cemetery that members believed was at least partially on private land. He also cited a state statute that allows any town to take charge of and maintain an abandoned or neglected burial ground within its limits. Statute authorizes towns to appropriate money for upkeep, but strictly prohibits property rights violations, body disinterment, or the destruction of historical structures. Detmold said, quote, people are related to these people and deserve to visit their remains, end quote. And he added, or to do genealogical research, end quote. Hoffman writes, for some education officials in Franklin County, the devil is in the details when it comes to the final high school graduation recommendations that have been released by the statewide K-12 Graduation Council. The council, established by an executive order from Governor Maura Healey to advise Beacon Hill on the development of new graduation requirements for high schoolers, released its 125-page report on June 25th. The report comes 18 months after the council was established and started developing a new framework for graduation standards after voters removed Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment System, or MCAS, as a graduation requirement via the passage of a ballot question in November 2024. Under the MCAS requirement, students would finish their high school journeys by completing all local graduation requirements and by earning a qualifying score on the MCAS. Students were tested in mathematics, English language arts, and science. The graduating classes of 2025 and 2026 are the first two graduating classes since MCAS was removed as a requirement to have earned the diplomas without a universal graduation standard. A new standard may still be years away, as the earliest implementation recommendations are for the 2027-2028 school year, and legislative action to make the recommended requirements law still needs to take place. But for now, the final recommendations from the statewide K-12 Graduation Council are seeing more questions than answers on how districts would be able to implement them, as rural schools face declining state aid and insufficient staffing. Quote, the details change the weight of the lift, end quote, said Darius Modestow, superintendent of the Frontier Regional and Union 38 school districts. Without MCAS as a graduation requirement, the proposed graduation framework includes four primary components. And they include bringing the Mass Corps program of study to all classrooms, implementing end-of-course exams that the state will design, administer, and grade, student participation in My Career and Academic Plan, or MICAP, and education on financial literacy, artificial intelligence, and digital literacy, along with education on the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA, and the Massachusetts Application for State Financial Aid, MASFA, and students creating a locally assessed capstone or portfolio of work to show what they've learned. The report proposes the implementation of the first Mass Corps cohort, entering ninth grade in 2027-2028, and implementing the other requirements the next school year with incoming freshmen. That means districts would have at least six more graduating classes before students could graduate in 2032, having achieved all the uniform standards contemplated by the council, 8 years following the ballot question's passage. Athol High School Principal David King said in a statement that the Athol-Royalston Regional School District and the AHS have, quote, embraced the state's vision of a graduate, end quote, and in the spring of 2025 adopted its own ARRSD vision of a graduate. King said, quote, with that vision in mind, we have made significant investments over the past year to strengthen MICAP implementation in our school. Through this, our students will participate in regular programming that is intended to provide them multiple opportunities to build skills, develop passions, and forge their own pathway to success. I am proud and continue to be excited about the educational future for our students, thanks to the commitment that Athol-Royalston has made in providing our students with opportunities such as early college, innovation career pathways, work-based learning, and rigorous high-quality courses such as advanced placement, Project Lead the Way, and other thoughtfully developed curriculum. He added, quote, our role as education leaders is to provide our students with multiple pathways to success and therefore believe the recommendations provided by the K-12 statewide graduation council are very much in alignment with what we have already been doing at Athol High School. I believe there is no single definition of success, but I am fully supportive of graduation requirements that recognize different student strengths and post-secondary goals rather than relying on a single measure such as MCAS, end quote. And notably, while MCAS was eliminated as a graduation requirement, under these new recommendations, students would take end-of-course exams within the Mass Corps program of study, scored by the state and county towards graduation. Currently, students are still taking the MCAS as a benchmark for school and district performance, and the end-of-course exams would not be rolled out until 2028. The Council's report explains that stakeholders who provided feedback for these recommendations sought a standardized measurement of mastery with emphasis on consistency between districts to understand and address any disparities across districts and student populations. End quote. It notes that some stakeholders see the value in standardized testing to prepare students for similar exams following their graduation from high school, but others shared concern for continuing to include standardized testing and whether it plays too large a part in earning a diploma. Stakeholder feedback was also provided in the report, including the results of a statewide survey where 51% of respondents agree or strongly agree that assessments or tests are how students should demonstrate, quote, learning and readiness for college, career, and civic life, end quote. On the other hand, 87% of respondents agree or strongly agree that a portfolio of work is best. The return of an exam as tied to graduation is something the Massachusetts Teachers Association, or MTA, has pushed back on, in light of MCAS being removed as a graduation requirement. In a joint statement, MTA President Max Page and Vice President Deb McCarthy said, quote, "We had high hopes for the Governor's Council on graduation requirements. But as we approach the second anniversary of voters passing the ballot measure to end the use of MCAS as a high school graduation requirement, we are troubled that the governor's two education officials tasked with developing new statewide graduation requirements have missed the opportunity that voters provided when approving Question 2, end quote. The MTA spearheaded the ballot question to remove MCAS as a graduation requirement. Ballot question supporters argue the test is a one-size-fits-all exam that doesn't properly measure student achievement, and it shouldn't be used as a barrier for the 1% of students each year who are unable to pass, but who otherwise meet the requirements necessary to graduate. Other statewide education organizations have shared concerns over the end-of-course assessment recommendations, with the Massachusetts Association of School Committees being deeply concerned regarding a lack of clarity about the exams, as noted in its May 2026 position paper, The Graduation Standard, while backing other recommendations. Doug Selwyn, a former teacher and chair of the Franklin County Continuing the Political Revolution's Education Task Force, was a yes vote for removing MCAS as a graduation requirement. He said he believes the council's recommendation essentially brings back standardized testing tied to graduation that voters opposed. Selwyn said, quote, "I think we're moving in absolutely the wrong direction, and we've already proven that in the last 30 years with MCAS. This is just more of the same, so I think it's a significant problem that I hope we can intervene," end quote. Similar to Selwyn, Stacy Sexton, who serves on the Greenfield School Committee, shared their personal thoughts on the recommendations, which they feel could equate to a siphoning away of resources from students. Sexton explained, quote, "It's not just money, it's also the time and attention. Because if we're asking all our educators to now get to know a whole new set of exams, that's time that they're not spending getting to know or deepening their own expertise in their core curriculum, or the time they're not spending devising very interesting assignments and things for students," end quote. In an email, Modestow explained he was opposed to MCAS being removed as a graduation requirement. He added there needs to be a system to meet federal guidelines for testing, and he has questions on how the proposed end-of-course exams would work. Quote, "For example, what happens if a student earns an A in a course but does not pass the end-of-course exam? How will students with IEPs, individualized education programs, and other learning needs be appropriately accommodated? Those scenarios could place teachers in difficult positions and create confusion for students and families about what truly determines competency," end quote. Modestow also wonders how the statewide K-12 graduation council's recommendations, if approved, could be implemented in far larger districts, especially when it comes to assessing the locally controlled capstone projects or portfolios. For Modestow and Elizabeth Dielinski, superintendent of the Ralph C. Mayer Regional and Union 73 school districts, the question is, how do schools make this work? Dielinski, like Modestow, said she was opposed to removing MCAS as a graduation requirement in 2024. She shared her concern at the time about ensuring student buy-in to still take an exam that doesn't count toward their diploma, but still impacts how schools are assessed, along with Massachusetts needing to create altogether new requirements to replace MCAS. Reflecting on the council's recommendations, Zielinski described them as honorable and educationally sound, but as it stands, she feels funding to implement the ideas remains questionable. Quote, "It's cost prohibitive, especially for rural poor districts," end quote, she said, adding schools are already struggling financially and find staff retention and hiring difficult. The Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents statement from Executive Director Mary Bork noted a similar concern over how schools might handle these mandates, but shared that the association believes the recommended graduation requirements will promote rigor and consistency across districts. The statement reads, quote, "We also recognize that the new mandates will require school districts to make significant investments of time and resources. And we call upon our partners in state government to provide the funding, support, and flexibility needed for effective implementation," end quote. The council's report does say that the state will help schools implement MassCorps by making $500,000 in grants available this summer to schools that still need to adopt the program of study. According to the Massachusetts Education to Career Research and Data Hub, 82.1% of all graduating students completed MassCorps in 2025. Even so, questions loom on how to get everything done. Modestow said, quote, "I think members of the statewide K-12 graduation council were under pressure to put something forward, and I think overall they're taking a big bite of a lot of things that are going to be without a lot of details on how schools are going to execute all of these changes," end quote. Abuse survivors say laws that fail them are now on their side. This is the next story in the Athol Daily News by Ella Adams from the State House News Service, July 31st publication. The survivors have spent over a decade telling anyone at the State House who would listen that Massachusetts needs a law to protect children from abuse by people in their life in positions of power, and they say a provision in the fiscal 2027 state budget finally gets their pleas across the finish line. When Governor Maura Healey signed the spending bill on July 9th, she signed into law both a policy she said addresses abuse of power by adults like teachers and coaches entrusted with the care of young people, and another that eliminates the statute of limitations in rape cases where new DNA evidence identifies the offender. Survivor Melissa Affairs said at a press conference Friday, quote, "I was failed by Massachusetts, failed by the adults who were supposed to protect me. For a long time, the law failed kids like me, too. This law doesn't give me back my youth. It doesn't give survivors back what was taken from them, but it closes a loophole that never should have existed," end quote. Former Miss Hall's school students, Fares, and Hillary Simon stood alongside state and public officials at a ceremonial bill signing at the State House held by the Healey administration to promote the policies. A large group of officials packed Nurses Hall, including Healey, Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll, State Police Colonel Jeffrey Noble, Representatives Leigh Davis, John Lawn, and Hannah Kane, Senators Joan Lovely and Lydia Edwards, and Berkshire District Attorney Timothy Shugrue, Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan, and Essex District Attorney Paul Tucker. Fares and Simon have both alleged their former teacher at the Pittsfield All-Girls Boarding School, Matthew Rutledge, groomed and raped them. Rutledge has pleaded not guilty. He was indicted in March on 3 counts of rape, according to Boston Globe reporting. Simon, who came to Massachusetts at the age of 14 for boarding school, said, quote, "My teacher began grooming me when I was 15. By the time I was 16, the law of Massachusetts treated me as though I could consent to the man who had power over me," end quote. Fares and Simon have been working for the past 2 years on getting the law changed, Simon said, but, quote, "We weren't the first. Survivors came to this building years ago and said what we have been saying to people who were not ready to listen. Every door we walked through, one of them pried open first," end quote. The new law dictates that people under the age of 18 would be unable to legally consent to sexual conduct with an adult who holds or has held supervisory or custodial authority over them. A redrafted Senator Joan Lovely amendment in the Senate's fiscal 2027 budget proposal slotted the policy into the final budget, which also implements an up to 20-year sentence for rape and up to 10 years for indecent assault and battery, Lovely said on the Senate floor in May. Those penalties do not apply, quote, if the defendant was not more than 4 years older than the child at the time of the alleged offense, end quote, per bill text, which Lovely called a, quote, narrow close-in-age exemption to protect peer relationships, end quote. On Friday, Lovely said, quote, "As a survivor at the age of 6, it's hard to talk about. You don't. It never leaves you. It's always there," end quote. And Lovely recalled, quote, "As a freshman senator, I sat in caucus and listened to colleagues questioning whether young people who came forward were telling the truth. 14 years ago, I had colleagues who, when we were passing the statute of limitations bill, said that doesn't happen. They're making it up. I was furious, and that's what propelled me to do this work, to find my voice to work on this and prevent this," end quote. Lawn, who was among several speakers who pointed to Lovely's work on the issue, said that he and the Salem Democrats share a club that we wish we didn't belong to. "I confided in her years ago. We worked on this behind the scenes until I was even able to share my story, but she knew," end quote. Lawn said, quote, all of us, everyone here, everyone out there, wants to send a message that in Massachusetts, if you harm a child, you will never walk away from that responsibility and the harm you've done, end quote. In May, Lawn wrote an op-ed in the Boston Globe calling on the state to eliminate the statute of limitations for childhood sexual abuse and opening up about his experience as a survivor. Speaking of the other provisions signed into law, Healy said the state for too long allowed the clock to run out on unresolved rape cases. State Rep. Adam Scanlon spoke about a case in which after 35 years, DNA identified the man responsible for assaults in a Framingham department store dressing room. Prosecution was possible because the attacker had left Massachusetts, Scanlon said, pausing the statute of limitations. Quote, but for many other survivors, the same DNA breakthrough would not have benefited them. Their attackers could have been identified and still escaped justice, not because the evidence failed, not because law enforcement failed, but because the law failed them, end quote, Scanlon said. He spoke on the House floor in April about the provision, noting Massachusetts had a 15-year statute of limitations for most sexual assault cases. So even if the DNA evidence clearly identified the perpetrator, prosecutions could be marred because time had passed. Said Scanlon, quote, this moment reminds us that our American justice system is always evolving. Our laws are not written in stone, end quote. Now, Healy's official announcement that she signed the budget just after 2 p.m. on July 9th with a photo of her, Administration of Finance Secretary Matthew Griscovich, and Senate President Karen Spilka. Healy did not include the budget signing on her public schedule and did not hold a budget signing press conference, which has been common over the years. Healy said Friday was, quote, about making sure our law reflects a clear difference between right and wrong. When someone abuses a position of trust, there has to be accountability. When science reveals the facts about an unresolved case, no statute of limitations should get in the way of justice, end quote. But up next, Athol considers raising liquor and car dealership license fees. This is by Greg Vine for the Athol Daily News from July 30th. The Select Board is considering increasing the cost of liquor and car dealership licenses, which have remained the same for many years. At its meeting on July 21st, the board was given information indicating that, with the exception of Royalston, Athol's fees for the seven different types of liquor licenses available are among the lowest compared to those charged by 11 nearby communities with similar populations. The cost of auto dealership licenses in Athol also tends to be among the lowest in comparison to nearby cities or towns. Town Manager Sam Sahosky said he, his finance team, and Executive Assistant Bridge Armentrout had researched the liquor license fees. Mount Wachusett Community College student Brandon Willett, an intern with the State Department of Revenue, also gathered information for the town. Sahosky said, quote, we want to make it clear that license fees have not changed in 60 years. So we had an intern do a study in comparison to other towns, looking at population, adding in Royalston, Wichita, and Orange to make sure they were in there as well, end quote. And he added, quote, we don't want to change the highest fees. I'm sure the board doesn't want to charge the highest fees, but we need to keep being current. If there's no value to a liquor license, then we should have a zero license fee, but there is value, and we are way behind the market on that, end quote. Sahosky urged the board to make a decision on whether to increase the license fees, quote, because the renewal notices will go out in a couple of months for 2027. That way, everybody would be advised if you were to make a change, end quote. The fees are not a one-time expense for new licenses and are charged each year when a license is renewed. Athol charges $750 for an all-alcohol pouring license for restaurants and bars, while the average for the other 11 communities is $1,125. For an all-alcohol package store, Athol charges $750, while other communities average $1,158. A beer and wine license for grocery and convenience stores in Athol costs $300, while the area average is $657. Athol's fees for beer and wine pouring licenses, all alcohol licenses for clubs, farmer winery pouring licenses, and one-day permits also tend to be lower than all or most of the other communities looked at. The town's finance team is recommending that as of January 1st, the town charge $1,000 for an all-alcohol pouring license, $1,000 for an all-alcohol package store license, and $500 for a beer and wine license. The fee for a beer and wine pouring license would rise from $300 to $500, as would a farmer winery license. An all-alcohol license for social clubs would remain at $750, and one-day permits would go from $25 up to $50. For automobile dealerships, the costs of a Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3 license in Athol are all set at $100. The average in other communities included in the survey is $148. The finance team recommends setting the cost of all three licenses at $150. Board Vice Chair Mark Maxwell suggested the board should consider keeping the one-day permit at $25. And he said, quote, because it's usually for groups and clubs and churches. Like for the Sportsman's Club, if they're doing a retirement party or something, I don't want to charge them too much money. The rest of the recommendations, I'm fine with, end quote. The board member Mitch Grosky said, quote, I may misread what the town sentiments will be, but I expect a lot of people will feel it's a difficult time for families and businesses and may hurt to raise license fees at this time. But at the same time, I think we have a valid case that says we should raise them, end quote. A select board will revisit the issue at its August 18th meeting with the intention of voting on the recommended increase. And we turn to the obituaries in the FL Daily News from July 31st. Karen L. Maselli, 67, of Charles Place in Athol, died Monday evening, July 27, 2026, at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center in Worcester. Born in Athol, May 30, 1959, she was the daughter of Carlos and Barbara Oliver Maselli and graduated from Athol High School with the class of 1978. Karen had worked for Kennametal, the ND class company, as well as MBW and Orange. Devoted to her family, Karen was especially loving of her grandsons. Karen enjoyed doing art, work, and beading. Karen is survived by her daughter, Sarah Newton, and her companion, Michael Boudreau of Athol, her longtime companion, Robert Lenther of Athol, grandsons, Ryu Spencer of Athol and Baron Spencer II of Connecticut, a sister, Barbara Beach of Orange, a brother, Alfred Brunel of Athol, a niece, Carrie Rico, and two nephews, Shane Rico and Charlie Rico. There are no services at this time. Donations in Karen's memory may be made to the town of Athol. Memo, North Quabbin Animal Shelter, Karen Maselli, care of Athol Police Department, 280 Exchange Street, Athol, Mass. 01331. Whitty's Funeral Home, 158 South Main Street, Orange, is assisting the family. Up next, my turn. Black cats treated like garbage. This is submitted by Shirley Majewski. Guess what? There are approximately 80 million feral cats in the United States. We throw away cats and kittens like we do our garbage. I'm not speaking without backup of some of these stats. We live near the South Deerfield Grammar School and near the loud Amtrak rails. We end up with at least 3 cats a year who come looking for food and a home. Few are chipped and often the owner does not want them back. Some are sick and almost all are starved. I called animal control when I saw a small black cat running on Hillside Road and the officer told me he is probably a barn cat and did nothing. They work and get paid by our town, so do something. It appears folks do not like black cats, and we have had a few, and they are wonderful kittens. The fallacy that black cats are bad luck is stupidity. We have another black kitty hanging around and starving at this very minute. We adopted the last cat, so now we own 2, and they do not get along. One is inside, and one is inside and out. The new cat, Blackie 2, came to us starving, not neutered, and he had been either hit by a car and left for dead and not chipped, of course. He is a good cat. Catches the moles and comes when called. Couldn't even get our dog to do that years ago. Now here's the problem. We can get this cat neutered via a Dakin, but they won't keep him. They neuter them and let them go. But go where? To hang around, bother all the other cats, kill birds, and starve to death? How nice is that? There's no animal shelter around here that wants them, and I have to ask myself, why? I know they're overcrowded, but what difference since they are black, they get cast away like garbage? I support many animal requests, but we are not rich. What will happen to this cat this winter in the cold? Get sick, starve, freeze to death? And he could make someone a nice pet. Just needs attention and love. My heart breaks for this cat and the many thousands more out there in the alleys, breeding, dying, and starving. I know they are cute as kittens, but we all age, them included. What are you going to do about it? I'll be sending this column to Governor Maura Healey. Will it do any good? I can try. There needs to be a solution to this issue, and I don't have one. Do you? Please get your animals neutered and give them a chance at life. And if you can, help the helpless. They will give you love in return. And if you see animal abuse, report it. Again, this column, the My Turn column by Shirley Majewski. A very quick look at the weather ahead in the Athol area. Thunderstorms for Monday are forecast, a high of 77, a low of 55. Sunny on Tuesday with a high of 84 and a low of 57. And then mostly cloudy Wednesday the 5th with a high of 84 and a low of 66. Evening thunderstorms on Thursday and Friday, the 6th and the 7th, with a high of 88 both days. And Saturday, the 8th, isolated thunderstorms at a high of 85 and a low of 64. And mostly sunny skies Sunday the 9th with a high of 86 and a low of 65 degrees. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Walter Bird. Thank you for listening.